We'll call the Conference Committee on House File 2323 to order. Welcome back, everybody. I've had growing concern with the economic situation, and I read in the paper today that, well, let me back up. Well, maybe 3 weeks ago, General Motors announced that they were going to close, I think, 2,600 dealerships nationwide or something, big number. And I talked with Scotty Lambert at the time to ask him kind of what the impact might be on Minnesota. And then I noticed in today's paper, I believe Chrysler is going to close 19 in Minnesota. So I talked with Alyssa Schlander and asked her if she could kind of come down to the committee and kind of give us a little idea kind of what the impact of this is going to be on Minnesota. I expect, Madam Chair, I kind of want to get this in front of us because these are pretty valuable pieces of property and very good locations, large parcels, and it seems like it's pretty good property for redevelopment. So I thought it would be a good discussion for us to have. I expect next session some members are going to come in with some legislation relative to these parcels, I suspect. So just wanted to get a little idea kind of around the state what this is going to look like. I'm sure many of these dealerships that are losing a product line probably still have other product lines they're going to sell, but some of them are likely not. So, Ms. Schlander, why don't you, if you could kind of give us a little idea what's going on in the automobile retail industry in Minnesota and maybe what kind of job impacts there may be, I think might be helpful for us to know. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you for inviting me, Mr. Chair members. My name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Chair, thank you for your concern about our industry. This is really a pretty serious time in the industry, and we have, we've been seeing a pretty steady decline in vehicle sales over the course of the last year, 18 months. We kind of hit a peak about 6 years ago, and compared to 6 years ago, the end of 2008 ended up 40% less than our peak. So we, in 2003, we sold a record 210,000 new vehicles. This year, we're on track to sell maybe 120,000 new vehicles, and that's a pretty steep decline. Sales were down by $2.2 billion last year, and we continue to be down by an average of 35% in the first quarter of 2009. We closed approximately 40 dealerships since January of 2008.
Four,
over the course of the last year. We were sort of seeing a dealership a month leading up to when the credit crisis hit in late September of 2008, and then we started to lose a dealership a week across the state of Minnesota. So those approximately 40 dealerships include stores that have shuttered and consolidations with other dealerships. However, we're expecting to see the closure of approximately 60 more dealerships between this week and approximately the end of the third quarter in 2010. As you mentioned, Mr. Chair, Chrysler filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on April 30th, rather. And part of their reorganization plan, as it's been relayed to us, includes an elimination of 35 to 40% of their dealership network across the country. Yesterday, they had to file with the federal bankruptcy court the list, their first swath, if you will, of the dealers that they intend to eliminate. That includes 18 dealerships in Minnesota so far. Those dealers will be terminated. They've asked the bankruptcy court to terminate those dealers effective June 9th. So that those are going to happen pretty soon. It is our understanding that list could still be expanded, and we are kind of expecting that list of Chrysler dealers to be expanded. Today, as you know, if you read the paper, General Motors began also notifying dealerships across the country of its intent to terminate their franchise agreements. Now, General Motors hasn't yet filed for bankruptcy protection or reorganization, rather. But, you know, the public indications that we're getting from the CEO is that that's more and more likely as they move to the June 1st deadline for the Federal Automotive Task Force. Part of the what's going on here now is that these companies, General Motors and Chrysler, they've both taken federal We're calling it not bailout money. It's
bailout money.
It's whatever. It's a loan. part of the deal there is that the Obama administration has appointed this automotive task force to oversee the reorganization of General Motors and Chrysler. And part of the requirements of the Federal Automotive Task Force has been that these manufacturers eliminate a certain percentage of the dealership network. And, you know, just as an aside, that doesn't make much sense to us since we don't cost the manufacturers anything. Nonetheless, that's the goal. And we are expecting General Motors to eliminate one-third of their dealerships. And so that will equal in Minnesota, that will equal an additional 50 dealerships. So between Chrysler and General Motors and the credit crisis, we're looking at losing 60 to 70 more dealerships over the course of 2009 and into 2010. And that equates to approximately 3,000 jobs across the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I know a few people that are dealership owners, and the ones that I know where I live are family businesses. And, you know, that's likely not that way in the metropolitan area for most of them probably, but I was pretty heartbroken when I read what General Motors was going to do because I thought of the people that I know that own dealerships who are really going to have their, you know, they're not only going to say goodbye to you probably on average, maybe 40 employees that work for them, but they're going to lose their business and have their lives turned upside down. And as I started to think about that, what they do have is probably a pretty good piece of property that it just seems like we ought to try to put our heads together and see if we could kind of incent the redevelopment of that. And my thought is, not that the current economic development TIF district wouldn't work, but in the state of the economy, there's just not a lot of redevelopment happening. And I kind of thought it would be worth us having a discussion and maybe staff thinking about a little bit. It just seems like as tipped upside down as these people's lives are, I think what most of them want to do is be able to move on. And the only thing many of them probably have left is that piece of land and a building that's probably not worth a lot. I don't even know how many of them could be renovated to become functional for some other purpose. I'm not sure if you think of what those dealerships are. You know, pretty big glass walls and not big buildings. Just seems like if there's some way to allow those people to get out from under that and kind of restart their life, it would be a discussion I think worth us having. And unfortunately, it's probably too late in the session to do much meaningful with it, but I just wanted people to have an opportunity to think about it because, you know, today it was 18 or 19 Chrysler dealerships. Next week we're probably going to read the General Motors list start to come out. And every one of those you read about, you know, these are good jobs in Minnesota that support families. And those 40 people that lose their jobs in there, most of those jobs are probably the breadwinners of those families. And just wanted us all to think about that a little bit. We all can think about where the dealerships are in our district and how people are impacted by that. So I guess all I would like people to do is think about, and there's something we maybe could do about it. Madam Chair, I don't even know what it is, except that I know I see, I mean, a significant problem with big vacant chunks of property on very good corridors, and I just have a desire to see if we can get them kind of back into the economy. And maybe that can't be done in the midst of a recession, I don't know, but I guess I just would like people to think about that maybe over the next day or two, and if anybody has some ideas, if you could share those with us, I think it would be worth our effort. The problems back in our communities aren't going to go away when we hit the gavel on Monday night and go home. So that, to the extent that we can kind of anticipate some of the things that might happen, if we could at all provide some kind of intuitive programming that might make it easier for people's lives before we get the discussion of it off for a whole year, I think is probably worth us spending a little time on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, so are you saying, I don't know if you've looked at the letter that's been provided from Minnesota Auto Dealers. I hear you to say you're looking for something besides this.
Well, Madam Chair, I just, when I contacted the auto dealers, I asked them if they could just supply us a list of some things that they think might help them with the redevelopment or the reuse or something of the property. So they supplied us with a two-page.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lencheski.
Yes, the reason I'm asking is all of these cost state money that I can tell.
Right.
And I think what I just heard you talking about was TIF, which would be property tax increases. But I don't see that on this list, but I do see a lot of things that cost state money. So, I mean, I guess, you know I'm not a fan of these subsidies, but I guess I'd ask the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, obviously these provisions all cost money. Are they willing to be supporting our tax increases? Because that's what it takes to pay for these things.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not necessarily proposing we implement anything on the list. I just asked them for some place maybe we could start a discussion from. And could be there's nothing in here we can do because of the budget times, but there's a lot of smart people in this room that have been through these kind of things long before many of us. And just would like people to give it some thought. I don't expect we're going to find a magic bullet here. But Senator Skoy?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think this is something we need to take a look at, as you've been saying. And at two of the dealerships on the list, Salem Motors in Crookston and Nearson Motors in Detroit Lakes, are on that list. And Salem Motors is on Highway 2 on the outskirts of Crookston, going to be a hole in that community. And if there is something that we can do, the jobs lost at a car dealership, it's a big part of that small town. I don't know if this is the answer, but like you say, if we could come up with something, it surely would be good and be helpful for these are not big towns that are losing these dealerships in some areas.
Rep. Lencheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just I want to take the time to put this in perspective, and it's not to pick on this group. If anything, it's maybe to pick on you. No, really, it's not to pick on this group, but I mean, this is the frustration I have. First of all, I don't like these corporate subsidies. But even if I did, what I really don't like is most of these groups criticize us for raising taxes, and that's how you pay for subsidies. Either pay for them through property tax increases through TIF, shifted on to everybody else, or you pay for these things through tax increases. And I just, quickly when I saw this and started reading it, I asked Mr. Michael and Ms. Manzi to take a crack at what these provisions might cost, just for perspective, and I asked Ms. Bergman to look up if this organization has taken positions on our tax increases. So just want you to know, and you can look at it yourself, this particular organization in April of this year appears to want the problem solved without tax increases. It is on record opposing a piece of your bill, the income tax increase, the 30% imposed on interest income, and is against that, and the fourth tier income tax, and it opposes the house tax bill, the county sales tax, and the Lincheski street utility. So, you know, people just can't have it both ways. It's frustrating to me. This letter from this organization suggesting that we maybe should look at these things, the first one that you all have, it says first, the Department of Revenue estimate in fiscal 10 is $82 million. Fiscal 11 is $32 million. Second item is about $250 million a year. The third, no idea, is what their writing is. And the fourth, don't know, but will probably be, will possibly be $100 million. I just have to say, I don't think we have time to think about corporate subsidies when we can't get revenue for schools and healthcare. I'll just tell you, I'm just being honest. It's difficult for me. And they all go together, and I think everybody wants to separate them. But, you know, here's a letter with $82 million in 10, $250 million a year, and $100 million a year. Where will we get that kind of money?
Madam Chair, rather than just say no, can't you recognize that we have a serious problem in many communities right now? I mean, I think of the community, the little town I live in, the car dealership out on Highway 53, good location, provides one of the larger employers in town. And I'm sure it's a problem. And I think to just say no and say, well, we're just not going to do anything, there's nothing we can do, I don't like those things, doesn't address the problem, the hole that's going to be left in some of these communities. And I guess I just think that when we can identify problems, we need to try and help people figure out solutions. And I don't have a clue what the solution is to this, except I'm pretty sure there's a problem in a whole lot of communities. And I think once you recognize that, and I got a feeling if we mulled it around for a while, we'd probably figure out something that maybe could make a difference. And you know, I mean, I feel for these small business owners that, you know, small business people, a whole lot of them, you know, they get up every morning and they go to work, and they're not much different than people that just pack a lunch bucket and go to work for somebody else, except that they have their whole life's investment wrapped up in that business and the security of their family wrapped up in that business. And when somebody comes, whether it's a General Motors or a Chrysler, decides to come along and pull the rug out from under you and pull the rug out from under your entire life's work, you know, the businesses, small businesses I know, feel in a lot of cases those employees become part of that family. And I would bet you there is a lot of pain going around those places today when those announcements came. And for those employees, for those owners who now are going to have to try pick up the pieces and their investment's been wiped out after maybe lifelong work, maybe it's second generation, and now they have to try pick up the pieces. So, Madam Chair, I'd just like you to think about, I don't think it's a time to think about politics. I think it's just a time to be willing to recognize that we've got a problem on our hands, and next year we're going to see some legislation on some of this stuff. I mean, some of us, and maybe some of us are on this table, are going to come with a bill about some piece of property on some highway in their community that they want to try incent somehow for redevelopment because it's left a big hole in that small town. And I just want to kind of get that on the table for people to think about. And if we can't figure something out by Monday to try and do, I just want to kind of put it on the table for people to think about, because I know when it shows up in some of these little weekly newspapers, for example, maybe in your community, in Senator Scoy's community, pretty painful.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jeske.
I mean, I'm not trying to be hostile. I just would tell you that I will bet that I have more of those businesses going out of business in my district than everybody sitting at this table combined. And it isn't just a small town issue. It's everywhere. And there's jobs. People need jobs in my community, too. And they work at these places, too. And this isn't politics. It's money. It's not politics. The frustration for me, and it isn't with you on raising revenue,
it shouldn't be.
It isn't. I think on net of 201 legislators and the governor, I've lost the argument. People are enthralled and enchanted with the corporate giveaway thing. People love it. I think it is a alluring brew that people fall for it. I don't buy it, but I'm in a minority in both bodies on that, and I accept that. So I do think the legislature has shown repeatedly it gives away property taxpayers' money and other people's income taxes and sales taxes for these initiatives under the supposed it's going to create jobs with no proof that it does. And I personally don't believe it, but I'm in a small minority. What I'm saying is for the majority of the legislature in both parties who thinks these are great ideas, many of these people and organizations and, you know, are you know, no taxes. That's the problem I have. You know, if everybody who needs an Angel credit and a Capco credit and this and the Mall of America and the Metzen bill, no offense to Senator Metzen, and every other thing would be out there rallying, raise our taxes, it'd be a little easier to take it seriously. But other than organized labor, I mean, most of the people who want these things are on the don't raise any taxes camp. And it's just a little frustrating. And it's not politics. It's money. Someone has to find $250 million and $100 million and $82 million. And it's just a lot harder when we're going to, you know, we're moving in a few days here potentially to being done with no revenue. It's just, and I don't see that going to be any different next session. I mean, I don't think the November forecast is going to have a surplus. So it's more for me, the people who will stand there and say, raise our taxes because we want this stuff, I don't have a problem with that. It's very consistent. Or don't raise our taxes and don't, we're not asking for anything. It's the folks who want something and don't want to raise taxes. That's where I get frustrated. That's all. It's money. It's a money problem. It's not politics. It's money. And I think every legislator should take that approach, even if they love these things. They should say, then you have to stand beside us and fight for tax increases, or we can't afford this. And I just don't see it. There's this, to me, there's dichotomy or separation or, you know, I don't want to be inflammatory and use worse words than that, that I have a difficult time with. It's just very frustrating because most of these groups that come before us are not on the, you know, raise fair taxes now crowd. It's just how I feel.
Madam Chair, I'm not advocating for a group.
I know.
And, you know, Senator Scoy made a really, really important observation in this committee. Was it last year or the year before?
Last year.
Okay. When he observed, and I think the comment was something along the line of, you know, rural members of the legislature bring a little different perspective to this table than metropolitan legislators do. Not to be critical of anybody, but we live kind of 6 months out in the countryside somewhere, and we live 6 months here. So I think we certainly understand the place we grew up in, but I think we understand here, too, because we spend much of our life here. And I tell people up north I'm going south for the winter.
Much of your life, not life.
And I've been here 15 years. That's not insignificant. But Madam Chair, I think Senator Scoy's observation was We understand the world you live in because we live here so much of the time, but you don't understand ours. And Senator Marty came to me, I think, that night up in my office and remarked about Senator Scoy's observation that Senator Marty said, Senator Scoy was right, I never thought about it. You do understand us better than we understand you because you have to live here for a big part of the year. And kind of to your point, Representative Lencheski, if somebody, and this may be an extreme time because of the recession, but generally speaking, if you lose your job down on 494, somewhere within a 30-minute commute here, you're going to find another job to support your family. And maybe not during, likely not during this recession, but in normal economic times, people lose their job, they don't have to relocate their family. But in many, many rural towns, when the breadwinner loses their job, that family has to relocate. And we have been painfully aware of that on the Iron Range. When mines shut down, and I mean, I have many, many, many friends I grew up with that left in the early 80s and moved here. Most of them settled somewhere on the north side of town, up in Anoka County, most of them. And some of them have come back. Many of them don't come back until they can retire, but it's different. And in many of these dealerships, these people who lose their jobs, those families are going to move because that's just what they're stuck with. So, and maybe that's why I find this so painful, because I've observed it, seen it happen to friends of mine. There just isn't a job within a 30-minute to 45-minute commute. So, and I'm not so naive to think we're going to find a solution here, but there's enough people in this room that if they think about it a little bit, it would be nice if we could do something rather than pretend like it's going to happen after we leave so we don't have to think about it.
Mr. Chair, we have to think about it, but Job Z didn't work. I mean, these ideas of tax incentives on geographic basis to keep people from, you know, being able to stay, I mean, it's clear it didn't work.
Madam Chair, we tried something.
Let's not try the stuff that doesn't work
tried
anymore.
Something.
And let's get proof that things work.
And it's hard to prove sometimes until you actually try something. And I am willing to try something, and if it fails, admit that it failed and try something else. But to just simply say no, that's just not the way I think. You know, everything doesn't have to work.
Well, right.
There's lots of different ways to get, and maybe it's because you're a carpenter. There's just lots of different ways to get the job done usually. And that's often why contractors, that's my big support of the idea of prevailing wage rates, is it levels the playing field on everything.
Agreed.
And the person with the most productive people and the most creative way to figure out how to get a project done, they're the low bid. And that's the kind of creativity and productivity we should be supporting. And
is there a prevailing wage in these jobs? I don't think so.
Senator Moy.
You know, Mr. Chair, I was watching the two of you as you had your exchange back and forth, and I think that it's really, it's heartwarming that when we, hearing you speak, Mr. Chair, I really identify with that, that when you read the headline, you see the faces of your neighbors and your friends and the people back at home. And I do that too, and I think Madam Chair sees that too, that with those of us here around this table, when we read the headlines in the morning, we don't just see headlines, but we see the real faces and the real lives of the real people whose lives are affected behind those headlines. And so, you know, that's why we're here at 11 on a Friday night when we could all be somewhere at home with our family. And but I think that Madam Chair here makes a really good point. And I don't think that it's politics to be thinking about the reality that we face as policymakers, that at some point some decisions have to be made. And I think that I'm energized, and I think around this table we're energized by the real faces and the real people with real problems behind those headlines. And so I would invite all the people in this room, and I think Madam Chair would agree with me because I experience your same level of frustration. I think it's really important to have all the ideas on the table, but those ideas have to come attached with a willing heart and a willing mind, because we've proven that, I have proven that for the faces and for the people I know who are affected, I have put my vote where my heart is. We've done that. We've said that in order to take care of the people in our communities, the small businesses, the big businesses, the most vulnerable, our children, our citizens and residents of Minnesota who need a job, we are willing to put our votes on the line. We are willing to craft solutions to make that happen. And I think Madam Chair here is articulating a frustration or maybe a sense of impatience that a lot of us have, that we don't have but very many days left of the legislative session. And I think her remarks, the way I see it, is not necessarily no, but an open invitation to say, if anybody else out there who are finally beginning to experience the same pain that we have been experiencing and are starting to see the real hurt behind some of these headlines, then let's step up to the table, offer us some ways we can help, but also offer up some solutions. Mm-hmm. Offer up some solutions. And some of those solutions, I think, means we need revenue. So I think that if people are willing to come to the table to say, here is a way that we can solve the problem, I don't think Madam Chair and I would have a problem to say, our arms are open wide, come on board, let's identify where some of the things that we can help resolve. And so I have to say that I am somewhat impatient that we have a lot of people around this building who have the ability and the power to speak on behalf of large groups of people with large blocks of interest, who are not willing to come to the table with us to have that conversation. And therefore, it ends up being, I think, almost a dishonorable conversation. In essence, it becomes all about us and how we're not helping people. You know, I don't like being tarred and feathered in the papers that somehow I'm just out to gouge everybody's taxes and I don't care about businesses. I mean, all throughout this legislative session, all we've heard is that, you know, people like me are out to hurt small businesses, and we're going to, you know, make businesses move to other states, and we're creating one of the worst climates for businesses. And we know that there are other factors that are converging our economy that are contributing to that. And I think that the legislature, I think our tax committee in the Senate, as well as the tax committee in the House, I think we've tried our very best to try to put some solutions on the table that's embracing of the continuum of players who we see as having some real needs. We've talked about what are some creative things we can do to help generate some jobs, help to preserve some businesses. And in the instances where we can't do anything at the state level to help, how do we help with a soft landing for families who may be losing their breadwinner, whose breadwinner may be losing their job and becoming jobless? How do we help to give them a soft landing? How do we help to secure health care? How do we help to create a soft landing so that we can all survive for the next 6 months or a year until we can all pick up the pieces again? So I think that this place, that we're still here, a couple of days left before the legislative session to have a conversation, I think it's a good place to kind of back up and have a broader conversation, both about the headlines that we read this morning, but I think that there are other needs, and I very much feel that we have to have the conversation about our dealerships closing, but I think we also have to have a conversation about all the unallotments that are going to take place. you know, what those consequences are going to be to our local communities, our local governments, and to our citizens. And so I have to say that I absolutely agree with Madam Chair, and I echo her thoughts and her frustrations. I've been feeling that all session, and I think that, Mr. Chair, your compassion and your heart wanting to do something is absolutely the right foundation. But let's not take too long to bring those partners to the table, because we are running out of time.
Thank you, Senator Moi. I refuse to give up. I mean, just remember what I said a couple weeks ago? There are less people working in Minnesota today than 6 years ago. Now, the status quo is not good enough. So, you know, somebody do something. And, Madam Chair, if it doesn't quite work, let's try something else. But do something. Anybody can manage the decline. How hard is that? That's real leadership. And the guy in the corner down there, the son of a truck driver, is not helping any. So maybe some of us got to step up and speak a little louder. Because you can look at trend lines, all kinds of measurements, where we're slipping. And we have to do something to turn that around. And there's enough people in this room with ideas that if we're all just willing to admit we've got some problems that we need to try solve, I think things can be turned around. Even in a recession, we can emerge. We can be one of the first states to where lending resumes. We know that's much of the problem. We're going to hear some about that, about projects ready to go that just somehow need to have a little of the risk taken out. The banks got nicked pretty hard here in the last year or two, and bank examiners, federal ones, are scrutinizing everything they do pretty seriously right now. Ms. Schlander, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Metzen?
Thank you very much.
What do you think of the tax committee?
I don't know. My name was mentioned already, and I just got here, so.
Well, I was here a little bit ago, but.
Senator Metzen, did you bring a handwriting sample?
Well, I'm here in person tonight because this is such a significant bill, I'm not doing it through memos this evening, so. But we think we've got a good idea here, and we're trying to do something. Personally, I think this is one of probably the most positive bills to come out of the Senate and the House this year. It hasn't come out of the House yet, but there's been we call this a Minnesota stimulus package to get jobs created in Minnesota. President Obama and administration has done a pretty good job, I think, in the transportation area and in the bridge area, but not in vertical construction area. This is intended to get our construction industry back to work in building buildings. This is not a project-specific bill. This is a statewide significant bill. This was brought to me. I would refer you to this piece in your packet. This Jobs Coalition Group has been working for over 5 months to put something together to get people back to work and to get our economy going again. This group is made up of builders, contractors, union leaders, architects, banks, cities, county officials, state officials, and the list goes on and on. This wasn't just dreamed up in the last week or two. It's been a long, hard process, a lot of time put into it, and you can see on your list there's about 80 to 85 different folks that are groups and folks that have been meeting on this. All diverse group, like I mentioned, from all over the state. And again, please don't let me get this out on the record right away. I've not personally talked to anybody from the Mall of America. This is not why I'm carrying this bill. I'm carrying this bill to put people to work. Right now, there's 30% to 50% of the construction workers are on the bench in Minnesota. I want to get those people to work. We've got lists, and if any member wants to see it privately, we've got lists of $3 to $5 billion worth of construction projects ready to go, shovel ready to go. What they need is a little help. The biggest part of the bill, I think, is the loan guarantee part. There's $100 million we're going to set aside the Department of Deed to guarantee a portion of the loan made by the banks. The banks are really tight-fisted here the last year or so. What we want to do is give them that little encouragement, like 15 to 25% loan guarantee on their lending ability. What they used to do was give out 75, 80% a loan to value and to projects that cash flow. Now, the way that things are going, they're just tightening up. So we think these creditworthy projects are still out there, and this would be, and of course, the banks would continue to do their due diligence. I mean, they're not going to just put the money out, but they would have the little added protection there that they need to make sure these loans, you know, they're going to do all of their cash flow analysis. They're going to do what everything they've done before. But this gives them that little edge. And the ideal situation, ideally, is that we don't lose any money on this. But that cannot be guaranteed. But they do put out the whole amount of the loan. They're still going to be put money from the developer. They're still going to be putting in their 15, 20% down. And this would be that gap, not financing on our part, but that gap guarantee. Again, you've got the banks doing the due diligence, and you've also got Deed looking at these things. So the two are there. The Deed is the backstop, if you will, and so it's got to make sense to the state, and it's got to make sense to the lender. So that's there's some initiatives here on green building, jobs, bonds for the cities. If they got some green building initiatives, things, or some incentives there. There's some energy conservation stuff in here. We've got a provision, I think it's Article 4 or Section 4, that extends a building permit extension for a year. You take out a building permit and you spend all that money and you just quite can't get to the goal line right away, we give you one more year. So you don't have to go in and spend the thousands of dollars. We've heard this in the Senate in five different committees, thoroughly reviewed. We passed it on the Minnesota Senate floor the other day with very bipartisan support. I might add Senator Senyum, minority leader in the Minnesota Senate, is on board here 100%. And the vote, I believe, was Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and members of 55 or 56 to 11. So we had real good support there. Another provision in here, we give some tax credit advance loans to first-time home buyers. The federal government has given $8,000 tax credits for first-time home buyers. We're through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We're going to find a way, and three or four other states have done it already, where you can advance that money, like $4,000 or $5,000 of the $8,000, to get that first-time home buyer that money up front to purchase that home. I think, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, and members, I think you've done something. Maybe you've done something, and like to keep it in this bill, but it deals with historic buildings, tax credits to keep these historic buildings going and give them some credit for saving these historic significant buildings out there. We do have some TIF extension in here. And I think that's kind of a quick overview, but when things are kind of not so pretty around the state with the economic conditions going on, I think we've got a project here that will work. Is it perfect? I don't know. But the downside is not a lot of money. Again, hopefully, maybe none of the money will be used. But it is a backstop, and if the I will say again to anybody who wants to see it, we don't, in the business world, I guess you just don't pass out these lists, but anybody who wants to see, we've got $3.5 to $4 billion shovel-ready projects that are ready to go. So with that, we've got a couple of, I've got a few of the coalition members here. I don't know how much time you want to spend on it, but I've got, why don't we get Mr. Herman up here and Mr. Hamilton with your permission and let them visit for a while, and I've got Mr. Anfang and Mr. David Simmerad from the Associated General Contractors. We've got union people. We've got everybody in all of these fields I mentioned that are involved in this legislation, and it's I think it could be one of the biggest probably stimulus thing to come around here in quite a while. So you, a couple of you guys want to?
Chairs, committee members, my name's John Hamilton. I'm the president of Urban Works, which used to be a medium-sized architectural firm in the North Loop in Minneapolis. We had 30 folks there. We're down to 13. The reason I'm here is to give you an idea of the scope of the problem that the construction industry is about to face. I have good friends at ESG. They're down to 25. They were at 96 a year ago. Anken and Kell, a 40-year-old office with 50 people, closed their doors. Opus is down by 75%. I talked to Steve Fiscom at HGA last week. They've worked their way out of their backlog. Their reduction hasn't really happened yet, but by mid-June, they'll lose over 50% of their staff. Talked to John Cunningham last night about Cunningham Group. Over 200 employees there. They're down about 22%. Their backlog will close out in May. Will close out in May. So what does that mean? Why is this happening? Architects are used to economic changes. We ride with the economy. We always have. We build the stuff that people need. When the market says show up, we show up, and we build what needs to be there. The market's not demanding very much right now for a whole lot of reasons because of the economy, but the projects that are still good, that have validity, that show cash flow, are not moving either. So in tight times, when everybody's looking for a project, the few projects that should go won't go, and they won't go because of credit. The credit demands just will not release those projects for construction to start. Now, how do I know that? Why would I sit here instead of some other architects? For the last 9 years, I've been chair of the Council of Firms, which is about 30 of the medium-sized and larger firms in the Twin Cities. The senior stockholders get together once a month and tell stories and try to understand where their industry is going and how to resolve problems and work collaboratively together. In October of last year, we saw our work fall off the table. As credit dried up, our developer friends came to us and said, we can't push these projects ahead. We don't understand. Our banks are missing our closing dates. We're not closing on projects that we think and have been promised will go ahead. We saw in October of last year the work in production drop off for the 22 firms that showed up in that meeting. In a general poll, work was off 40%. It has gotten significantly, as I told you above, significantly worse than that. I get to sit on one other committee. I sit on the steering committee for the design build industry of America, and that's the contractor side. And I began to talk to the contractors in October and November. In October, they were good. In November, they were in a pickle. It stopped that quick. And they could see the tension coming. Architects, by definition, are the canaries in the coal mine. If we don't draw it, they don't build it. We pretty much stopped drawing it back in October, and we're not drawing at all now. Work is not in production. What is that going to mean for construction in summer of 2009? These folks will tell you that story, but it's not going to be very pretty. One of the questions that seems to come up is, what is this construction industry and what is vertical construction? Well, vertical construction is simple. It's just buildings. It's the major commercial buildings that are built by the trades, largely in the Twin Cities, but certainly all over the state. But one thing that most of us aren't even aware of is how powerful a machine we've built up here in Minnesota. The McGuff, Mortenson, Weiss, A&P, Ryan, Opus, Krauss Anderson, and other teams are some of the top 100 contracting firms in the nation. They export design all over the country, or export construction all over the country and all over the world. One of the things that none of us seem to realize, nobody I talk to seems to realize, is that most of the larger architectural firms in the Twin Cities export design outside Minnesota and outside the country. HGA, KKE, RSP, 80-90% of their work is exported. There's a real powerhouse of architecture and design here and construction. It came from lots of different places. It came from that Midwestern work ethic. It came from the ability to draw from the other states to a very powerful design school at the University of Minnesota. But it's here, and it's coming apart in big chunks. I spend most of my time now writing letters of recommendation to architects who are applying for jobs in New Orleans and Raleigh and Seattle and Boston and other places that don't have that aggregate powerhouse to do the work. If we lose it, it won't come back. So what's the job coalition about? What is it? What did we do? Back in October, right after that meeting, I called John Herman and said, holy smokes, John, things are not looking good. After our November meeting, I said, we got to do something. We set up a meeting in John's office at Fagery's office. It seemed to be neutral territory that wasn't architect or contractor, and began to invite our construction friends. The first meeting had 16 attendees. The second meeting had about 25. Everybody was saying the same thing, and it was grassroots, ragtag, get-together saying, you know, let's not whine, let's do something. We're the people. Architects by nature don't sit back and let the world go by. We do something. We like to build things. We saw a problem, we set out to fix it. But it was a problem we didn't understand how to fix. We don't know how to fix an economy. So we called John and said, we got a big problem, and we need some help to address this. And the coalition built from there. One of the things that the Jobs Coalition is not, it is not about a project. It is project neutral. It's really not project neutral. It's project positive. It wants to see this work go ahead. We can't handle neutral. We can't handle waiting. When you look at the size of the problem for us and hear the size of the problem that construction is going to bring to you, it's a big problem. We think we have good solutions for you. That's my two cents.
Mr. Hamilton, thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is John Herman. I'm a partner in the real estate and real estate finance group at Fagery. I guess I could say from a personal perspective, our experience is a little bit like the architects. We're in the deals at the beginning. We work usually with the expectation of getting paid when the project goes forward. And we've seen essentially the same circumstances arise over the last 4 months. And my group, which is, I believe, the largest real estate group in the state, we have literally almost no new development projects in the group. And the projects that we do have that have moved for months through various kinds of pipelines, whether they're the low-income housing pipeline or other developments that are working through city permitting, by and large have reached the point where we sit down with the client and the client says, we can't make the financing work anymore because the lenders just won't provide us the level of financing they did previously. There are a lot of markets which don't have demand right now. Nobody's suggesting we ought to be stimulating those. We don't need more condos. We probably don't need very much more retail space at this particular time. But we have a high demand for residential rental. We have a pretty high demand for a variety of institutional uses. We still are seeing some reasonable demand for manufacturing. And these kind of clients are seeing the same kinds of problems. There is simply either no credit available or the credit's available at levels like 50 or 60% loan to value, which aren't allowing the deals to happen. So as John said, we're both kind of volunteers to this effort. He called me, I called the Society of Architects, and we started putting a little list together of people to get together in a meeting, and we started asking the question, how could we make many of these projects, which are good developments that make economic sense, happen in this kind of environment before we lose a good chunk of the infrastructure of one of the state's big exporting industries? We're often ranked fifth or sixth in the country in architecture and engineering, which obviously greatly exceeds our marketplace size of 13th in the country. So we brought these groups together, and then pretty soon we were asked to join a bigger group that the AFL-CIO was having meet at their offices. And I think I could say that there's one touchstone in the legislation, and that was that we were trying to think of ideas, because this isn't like the government bonding and building a building at the University of Minnesota where you guys may put up two-thirds and tell them to raise a third or bond themselves for a third, or building a project for DNR where you pay 100%. We were trying to think of ways that we could ask the state to help us that would either not cost anything or would be a leverage program that would engender 6 to 10 times private investment for whatever the public was either investing or putting at risk. And so I think the bill doesn't have, with the exception of the two tax credits for the low-income projects and the historic projects, doesn't have within it the concept of direct appropriation. What it has is the concept of trying to encourage financing or reduce costs or put us in a position to make the deals happen. So our concept was try to have small cost and large aggregate production. So, for example, in the loan guarantee program, obviously we hope none of the loans go bad. There's a lot of state experience in loan guarantees at the Housing Finance Agency. There's actually a fair amount of experience in a couple of smaller programs at DEED, and the concept would be $500 million of guarantees that would leverage $2 million total of loans and $2 billion of loans, because it could guarantee up to 25% and $2.5 billion of development. That's a typical example. So we were focused on trying to encourage either equity investment or financing investment. Let me spend a couple minutes on a couple of the sections. It's way past my bedtime, and probably the committee's got more endurance than most of the rest of us. We've talked a bit about this loan guarantee. The idea there would be the state would create a small amount of funding in the guarantee fund that would credit enhance bank lending, and we think generate 75 to 80% loans instead of the 50% that are commonly being offered. In Representative Lencheski's committee the other day, I gave an example of the underpinning of this idea from an actual success story with a very similar program that Minneapolis has available for industrial projects. I had a client that is very creditworthy, planning a $22 million data center and headquarters for their computer operation, which manages electric generation distribution throughout the country. They went to their lending organization, and even though they're a very cash-rich company with more than $10 million in cash available at the moment, the lender said, yeah, we'll make a loan. We'd love to lend to you 50% loan-to-value ratio. The project became instantly infeasible. They'd had no money for corporate expansion. Minneapolis has a guaranteed loan fund, and they actually provide 100% guarantee. It's a rated fund that Minneapolis has for manufacturing facilities. This recently was added to manufacturing by some changes in Congress, and they've offered to go between 18 and 20 million of loan to value on the fund. They'll lend up to 90%. So now the project's going forward. I think it's a sensible way to work. Obviously, nobody's suggesting projects be funded that don't go through both a scrupulous bank review and an equally scrupulous review by the state guarantee agency. We've suggested two tax credit ideas: the low-income housing tax credit, which about a dozen states have, and we've modeled our program after Massachusetts. I've actually suggested in some conversations that we consider shortening the tax credit period from 10 years to 5 to get a little better efficiency, but the program has worked quite well in the states that have it structured as we've proposed, where the credits are certificated. It would cost 1/10, as it's written, or 1/5 if we shortened it, of the amount of the credit value in the first biennium, and I think it would generate roughly 3.5 times that much money for investment in the project. So we get some pretty sizable leverage to close the gaps, not only on the 9% credit project, of which we have projects going back, I think, to 2007 that haven't managed to be built yet, but also I think would leverage the 4% credit project, of which we have a very substantial, virtually unlimited number, because we have a lot of capacity for this under federal law, and there's simply no marketplace today for the 4% credit. We think maybe by putting the state credit with the federal, it would make those marketable. We have the historic credits, which I know you have heard about endlessly. We have a couple of ideas in here that I think are really good ideas that actually don't cost any money. Extending building permits for projects that were ready to go but aren't going. Why should people, because they're stopped due to the economy, have to go through a land use entitlement and building permit process a second time because a year goes by and their permit expires? It's pretty simple. In fact, Minneapolis has already done it by ordinance to extend those permits, and this would just make it statewide and automatic. And we've suggested allowing Chapter 429 special assessment financing for energy improvements, which has been an incredibly successful program for water quality improvements. You added that as an area of special assessment authority. The owner petitions for it. They pay the specials. It has priority over their mortgage. They don't have to go out and get a second mortgage, which isn't available, or ask their lender for approval to put subordinate financing on. And yet you could finance it with no cost at all to the state or to anybody else as a taxpayer. And we have this monetization of the first-time home buyer, which we think might cost a little bit up front, but the state will get all the money back. I think 7 states have actually done this. And we've suggested some extensions of TIF districts where it would energize projects in a short time period. I think Bob Schreier is here and can speak to that better than myself. I'd be happy to answer questions, but I think our hope is that with a very modest amount of money, we think less than $125 million of scored cost for the programs that are here, and most of that is the $100 million that goes into the loan fund, we could energize projects that might total between $2.5 and $3 billion. So I hope the committee will consider it. I think, yes, there is some expense to it. I would say, actually, Mr. Hamilton and I are in that group of people who've been supporters of a little higher taxes, to respond to Representative Lencheski's well-placed criticism previously. And we think that this would be a pretty economic way. I know the state won't do dynamic scoring, but would be a pretty economical way to potentially generate a really fairly sizable increment in state tax revenues, because this industry is so flat on its back right now, way beyond any other individual sector, including, frankly, the auto sector. It's so flat on its back, and it has such a long timeline that if we can keep these engines moving a little bit, I think the state will see a dynamic overall benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Herman.
I want to ask questions. You want to get through them? Why
don't we get through these two?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Lencheski, go ahead.
I'm glad to hear that you support tax increases. That's interesting. I should just tell you that the House Tax Committee considered raising the sales or beginning to tax architects, which would raise $170 million a year. They're exempt from sales tax. They're getting a pretty good deal. And we looked at taxing legal services as the governor's 21st Century Commission recommended. That would raise $225 over the biennium. And we looked at financial services. These are all beneficiaries of this kind of a bill. And so I'm glad to hear that folks would be open to that, because these taxes, we spent a lot of time doing zero-based budgeting, and we actually looked at all the tax expenditures, which, for folks who don't know what those are, those mean people who don't have to pay taxes, they're exempt from something. And in that process, we used the Department of Revenue's work, Dr. Wilson's work, and actually Mr. Michael and his staff went through a whole bunch of selected tax expenditures and did the actual tax incidence burden on the taxes I'm just talking about, legal services and architects, and I can point this out. And these are, if we were to impose those taxes, it would be a very progressive change for the Minnesota tax code, because it is the wealthiest Minnesotans who benefit that these items are not taxed. And I can pass this out for you. So I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, that would be one way to pay for all these things, is to tax some of the beneficiaries of these things. But I really do have questions about, you know, I think some of this stuff is good. I mean, we had a long hearing, not with these people, but on the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency chunk, and actually pretty much rejected it outright, bipartisanly, reworked it, Representative Dabney's bill, and came up with a better alternative, because in this bill, it's really the developers and the realtors and the folks who would benefit from the home sale don't have to pay the embedded cost. It's the homeowner who has to, and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. So I think you would like, I would hope you would like to learn about how we think we dramatically improved on that approach that's in this bill. Of course, the historical credit is an annual thing. I think the special assessments on the energy stuff is pretty good. But I think the pieces that have been talked about here that are of most controversy to me are TIF extensions, because those are significant and dramatic property tax increases across the state, and the loan guarantee. So to Mr. Hamilton, who I've never met, my husband used to work at LRB Beckett, I totally understand the world of what you're dealing in. Your industry is like everybody's. I mean, there's job loss all over this nation. So I hear you there. You know, there's everybody's hurting, architects and car dealers and everybody. But I really do want to understand this loan guarantee, because I agree that it's not project specific. I think there's been a lot of confusion. I think, in fact, in the House, we have all these members who think this is where the Mall of America is hidden. It's actually in the TIF provisions. So I understand that the loan guarantee is not to fund the Mall of America, and I've always understood that. But I do know that a 10-year TIF extension funds the Mall of America. That's a different issue. The loan guarantee, however, I was even asked, did I want to see the list? And I said no, because that's not the issue for me. That's not the issue for me. I mean, I want to understand if we were really to proceed with this, you know, and I think if people heard folks say this in the House Tax Committee in lots of ways, but I think one of the core issues is, you know, I really need to hear a really defensible argument about why bankers who are expert in making these loan underwriting decisions and have concluded that these are too risky to make, why should the state step in and guarantee loans? And I know people want to think there's no cost to that because it's just guaranteeing a loan, not giving them the money, but there is a cost to that. And the revenue estimate will show that. It's backed by sales tax receipts. So there is absolutely a cost to that from the state, or folks wouldn't be here asking for it. I mean, if it didn't cost money, there would be no reason to be here. But why should the state, you know, step in and guarantee loans to the private sector that the private sector won't? And I have stated before, you know, I think that the legislature misstepped, and Senator Langseth and Representative Hausman maybe should have bonded for $1 billion. And, in fact, I can make available to the committee, I asked earlier because I thought we might, you know, eventually talk about this, for a list of all the things that the Senator Langseth and Senator Representative Hausman had to say no to this year, $717 million of projects. That would certainly put a lot of people to work, and it would be controlled by the public sector. So, I mean, I'll hand this out, but, I mean, to me it seems if the idea is to get people in construction working, there's a lot of ways to do it without getting off into becoming a state bank or nationalized banking and assuming risk. So I really, truly, on economic principles, want to understand why the taxpayers of Minnesota should take a risk and become a bank for projects that the private capitalists who make these decisions every day and will not. Why should the Minnesota state government do that? I'm just confounded. So if either one of you can tell me, you know, why we would use our limited resources up against everything else we're competing in, and in my estimation, something very risky, I'd just like to hear it.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know that. I mean, the banks are going to do the due diligence on the project. I don't know if I would describe the projects as risky.
Too risky to get a loan.
I think, well, Senator Metzen knows a great deal about banking. Yes. Senator Metzen, tell us about what the financial institutions are facing relative to the federal bank examiners.
Well, they're just scared to death. I mean, all the, you know, the bad stuff that went on, and now when things are turning around, the regulators are just saying, stop, slow down. And you can go in and see the cash flow. They work. The loan-to-value works. And it's not like it's the end of the world. This is $100 million of a $35 billion budget. I mean, and you're not going to lose all of that. And you've got the due diligence is still going to be there. And, again, I repeat for the second or third time, the department deed looks at this, and it's got to pass their test. So you get two backstops here. So this is because of the economic times we're going through. The bankers are just scared to death because of their regulations. And these are good projects. And you know, $100 million, you know, to create $3 billion worth of buildings. I don't know. You talk about the risk. Is the state involved in other stuff? I think so. I'd like to see a billion-dollar bonding bill, too, but it's not going to happen. So this is our attempt to get people to work, to get people to pay income taxes, to get the buildings to pay income taxes. And once you build these buildings, people work in these buildings. They work in these $3 billion worth of buildings. And I just think it's a win-win thing. And if the world collapses, that's representative. I understand $100 million is a lot of money, but we're not going to, you know. And this would give that, just that put, that leverage to get those bankers to get over the hump until times get better, which they should a year or two from now. Then they'll go back to how they used to do things the right way or used to put out money. But, it's a small part of the state to get things going. So,
Representative Lynchess.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator
Benson. What we want to do is we want to talk positively around this building instead of saying how we can't. You know, I get tired. And I've been saying this all my life in the legislature. Don't tell me how we can't do something. How can we do something? Let's try something. And I've been, let's go forward. Let's try. And this is not going to, this is a positive approach, and we should be, I think we should be jumping up and down and saying, here, somebody's coming forward with, put people to work and not, and is it a bad thing that the state guarantees some stuff? I don't know. I don't think it's a bad thing.
Senator Metzen, I can tell I'm frustrating you. I do that to a lot of people, and I apologize that it's frustrating. And I do think most people think.
Yes, I've heard you. Let's step back and let's say, gee whiz, here's something probably pretty good.
So let's do that, okay? Here's what I'm saying. I think most people are with you, actually. I'm not one of them. But if the legislature would think this is a good idea, we better do it right. And so, let's step back and do it then. And let's make it work. And so that's why I want to understand it. For example, and I don't understand banking, and you do. So in a serious way, I asked our staff to tell me when the state has done something like this before, okay? And that would be, stimulate economic development by using state credit to back not public projects but private projects. And the result that I learned was it has been done a couple times, and the results were disastrous. And that is, in the 19th century, the state helped finance railroad construction by issuing bonds. Many of the railroads defaulted. The state was unable to pay the bonds. The upshot was the Constitution was amended to prohibit similar efforts. In fact, Article 11, Section 2 of the Constitution says the credit of the state shall not be given or loaned in aid of any individual, association, or corporate except as hereinafter provided. Then it took years and the efforts of Governor Pillsbury to cure this problem that the state went through. Then in the 20s, the state issued bonds to finance agricultural loans under an exemption under the Constitution and had similar disastrous results. Since then, the state hasn't done this. So if we're going to do it, we have to know that this is going to work. So, one huge area I have a concern about is deed. And so, Senator Metzen, maybe you can tell me this very directly. Who at deed, either a name or, a name would be good, has the expertise that this bill would require to judge whether a project's cash flow is going to be adequate to repay the loan? I mean, somebody has to make that decision because it's not going to be bankers now. It's going to be deed. So, and deed doesn't have the best track record. So, in reading the bill, it says deed decides whether to issue a guarantee based on primary consideration. And so I'm wondering who in deed is going to be, make this judgment, and will it be necessary for deed to hire people from the banking and loan underwriting areas with the right expertise to make these decisions? I mean, even if I thought this was a great idea, I don't even see how it works yet. So I really do want to understand it, because if we go forward with this year or another year, we got to get it right.
Senator Metzen.
We're not going to, I think we got involved with the Northwest Airlines, and they never missed a beat on their payments.
Those public buildings.
They never missed a payment.
Well, Ms. Senator Metzen and Mr. That was a public. Those were public buildings.
But it was a $250 million? What was the number? Loan to a private company.
Yeah. So, I don't know about the railroads back in the 1880s,
still paying it.
But
The most recent modern one was paid back, or is being paid back. Never missed a payment. So.
Mr. Lyons was put.
Yeah, don't, you know.
Ms.
I don't know what deed. I mean, deeds got to have expertise. They're, you know.
Ms. Cadoon, do you know, and if you can't answer this, maybe you could, by tomorrow, get some answer for us. Does the governor have any interest in trying to put together something to see if we can stimulate this industry or not? And I don't, if you don't think you can answer that, I understand that, but if you've had this discussion with the governor, it would be helpful to know.
Mr. Chair, I haven't had this discussion with the governor's office, so I can certainly check into what their position is on this.
Ms. Cadoon, here's my thought. It seems reasonable to me that in this tax bill, in these final few days, and if you could express this to the governor for me, if we could create some incentives like this, or the angel credit, or the historic credit, or the CAFCO program, it just seems to me we should be able to somehow score those economic stimulus packages and tax credits as tax reductions. And somehow on the other side, it seems like we should be willing to raise some money to help pay for them. And I think the governor could argue that when it's all put together, there's not a tax increase. That there's, for the new revenue raised, there is offsetting reductions or stimulus. And Commissioner, I just asked the question of Ms. Cadoon if the governor has had any briefing on this Senator Metzen's bill relative to a loan guarantee program as an economic stimulus, and if there's some way it could fit into the tax bill, some revenue to pay for it, and make the argument that there is some offsetting tax relief, that at the end of the day, it's a revenue-neutral proposal. I would like to know, by sometime tomorrow, if the governor's willing to give it any consideration, or if we're all just wasting our time here. I mean, a lot of people put a lot of effort into this, and I'm sure it's not thoroughly vetted yet, and we've got a couple more days to do that. But I guess I would like to know, Commissioner, by tomorrow, if we should spend any additional time on it, or if it's just something he's not willing to consider.
Yeah, Chairman, I can check with the governor's office and the governor himself. I do know that he's been briefed on the proposal as originally introduced, and I know it's gone through a number of iterations since then. But I will find out if he's had a discussion regarding economic stimulus impact and whether that could be counted as tax reduction and such. So I can get back to you pretty short order, hopefully by tomorrow.
Commissioner, I'd appreciate that, and the governor wants to visit about it. I'm certainly available to do that. But I mean, I'm going to say it again. This session has to be about more than just balancing a budget. It just doesn't seem like enough to me for us all to go home, fold up our tents here, and I'm going to go fishing next Wednesday. And I sure would feel a lot better leaving knowing that we did something to create some kind of stimulus, something. That we didn't just fold it up and just going to let the cards kind of fall. Because I think, when we look at Commissioner, I think you and I have talked about the most recent revenue numbers from February and March and April, and we're running below the February forecast. And it seems like when I think back on Global Insights numbers, the probability of the pessimistic forecast seems higher than the probability of an optimistic forecast. So I think, Commissioner, I'd like the governor to take a real hard look at including some kind of economic stimulus provisions in the tax bill. Because I don't know, I just can't say it strong enough. I mean, I have a lot of friends in this industry, both on the contractor side and on the architect side, and I'm one of those guys that's carried a lunch bucket and been in a situation of not having any work, and I know what it feels like. And I know what it feels like when you've been on unemployment long enough that now you don't have health insurance anymore. And it just would be good if the governor would be willing to consider something here.
Mr. Chair, can I move that with a vote of the committee that we meet until 1 o'clock at this time?
On the Lincheski motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no, the motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
Mr. Innes.
Senator Metzen.
Could a South St. Paul boy meet with the truck driver, South St. Paul guy tomorrow and visit with him about this personally? If you could see if you could arrange that, I'd like to give the pitch. And
Commissioner, I think Senator Metzen makes a good point. I mean, I think somewhere privately, some of us need to have a discussion with the governor about the fact that we have an entire industry flat on its back, and it's a big piece of this state's economy, and it just seems like if there's something we can do, we ought to give something a try. So if you could express that to the governor, that maybe Senator Metzen and I and maybe a couple of other people that have been advocating for this, yeah, we could have a discussion with the governor on this. I think a lot of people could benefit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
If the Senate is, and the governor's office is going to meet on this, the House would like to be included, so I'm sure we'll be wanting to be a part of that.
You got
to
help us, though.
Well, okay. You know, if we're going to do this, and, you know, again, it only takes 3 votes on each side to do it. So doesn't well, have to be me. It has to be done correctly. And I think, for example, it just says if you create jobs, which could be 2, you qualify. I don't think anybody would think that's acceptable to write a bill this way. I mean, we don't even let Job Z get away with that.
Representative Lincheski, all
clear in jobs data, prevailing wage. There's all kinds of things that we could be working through here.
Representative Lincheski, tiny steps.
Right.
I mean, first I'd like to find out if the governor has any interest. I mean, I think that's where we need to start. I think the sooner we know that, the sooner we can put some people to work on refining this proposal so it's something that'll work. Because you clearly heard me say this likely hasn't been vetted well enough. And I'll be the first one to admit that. And to the commissioner and to the governor, I don't want to get bogged down in the words. I just want to kind of take a look at the concept if there's any interest in some kind of a stimulus to try to do something for this very important industry.
Great. Mr. Chair, if I may, on the modeling, the dynamic versus static, we get this question a lot from newer members of the Tax Committee and people kind of, what? Why can't we say that if we do this thing later, there'll be jobs and then there'll be taxes and therefore it's a net zero? I mean, you know, I do think folks should be reminded on that. I mean, we could have Dr. Wilson give a primer, but I mean, that obviously can't work. It sounds good. But then we would have to do that for every dollar we invest in K-12. It would show we're going to have an educated worker who's going to earn this much. And so nothing would ever cost anything, would be the net effect of modeling that way. And so we can't go there.
Madam Chair, I'm with you.
Right. And so, but advocates need to hear that because their instincts are correct, that when government spends money on something, sometimes it gets some good results, and then some people pay taxes, whether it's higher ed or K-12 or roads or these kind of projects. But you have to do it to everything. You can't just do it to your bill. Okay, so the net effect of, you know, the K-12 bill would have shown, you know, massive infusions of income tax receipts over, you know, the next 25 years. So, I mean, I just think for folks, it gets to be a non-starter when they really think about it, because you have to do it for every single bill then, and you can't necessarily ascertain where the money goes. But the multiplier effects are real. I mean, I would say that. But I do think people get frustrated with the fact that the Tax Committee has to count what they view as tax cuts as spending. And it is spending, and I know people don't want to think about it that way, but we have to find the money to make it go. So that's why we do modeling that way in Minnesota, and I think it's the fiscally conservative way to do it.
Mr. Antfang has to go out of town early tomorrow morning, so could we?
Are you in recess?
Mr. Antfang? Oh. No, we're open for business.
Oh,
1 o'clock.
Recess. How'd you get that out of it? These guys work hard. I apologize to my colleagues on the coalition. I thought you were going to end discussion. And
Mr. Antfang, your name and who you represent for the record.
For the record, my name is Dick Antfang. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. And this evening, and this testimony is probably going to be the last testimony that I ever give in front of a legislative committee in this building. Because I'm going out of town tomorrow, and the session will more than likely be over before I get back. So I want to thank the legislators for getting us this far and taking this under consideration for this amount of time at this late date in the session. But I've been asked a number of times, why is it so late? And the simple answer, I think, is this, that the industry, like the auto industry, changed very rapidly. And by the time people started to realize how quickly and how bad the downturn was, individuals were thinking about how bad it affects them, and then they started to think about how it affects others. And a long story short, that's how the coalition started. We became united as an industry. All the very facets of the industry became aware that something needed to be done. And I want to thank Senator Meemaw for her statement earlier and Senator Bach for his statement earlier, where Senator Bach said, somebody do something. When the industry sat down and looked across the table many, many, many times, we decided, quite frankly, The folks in the legislature that campaigned on jobs, jobs, jobs weren't working very hard on jobs, jobs, jobs. So what do we do? John was exactly right. What can we do? The private sector is coming together to ask for a little help and put ideas on the table. Somebody do something. Senator Moore says, put solutions on the table. The private sector's coming to the elected officials, people that have the power to help when we can't help ourselves. That's the function of government. So we're here to ask you to consider this, whether it's exactly this bill or not, but it needs something very similar to this. The industry knows what it needs. The answers to your questions are all there. But you have to be willing to hear the answers and accept what they are as the truth. And in terms of bonding, Madam Chair, the bonding dollars are $750 million worth of bonding additional wouldn't touch what this bill can do. It wouldn't touch what this bill can do over time. And those bonding dollars are taxpayers' dollars, too. And they're only going into public buildings. There's not one penny of private dollars leveraged by it. This will leverage billions of private dollars, creating more jobs. And so as a member of organized labor all my life and working in this political arena for a while and representing the construction workers, of which we are but a small part of this industry. We're the union sector. There's a lot of non-union people out there, good non-union people that are work very hard and they're trained and skilled, and they're out of work too. Thank God we're around here to help represent them too. We always have done that, and we always will. We'll worry about who gets the work later. But first of all, the industry's got to be productive. The engine's got to be running. And that's why we're here. Help us keep this engine running before the oil runs out of it and it blows up. And that's what's going to happen. So in my capacity as president of the building trades for a few more months, I'm asking you to very, very seriously do what you can. I know you can do. Have the courage to try something and do it. Create some jobs for people that want to work, people that are trained to work, people that make this state turn, make the economy run. Construction workers are paid well. They pay more taxes than anybody. And, Madam Chair, you have never heard anybody from the building trades
in an elected position say, don't raise my taxes, but spend them wisely. And we think if there's any money spent here, it's a wise expenditure. So with that, I hope you'll listen to later in the evening or as we go on to my other colleagues. But I just stepped up here because I thought you were going to end it, and I just wanted to.
Representative Deed.
Mr. Angpeng?
Yeah.
So Representative Chesky's got.
I do want to thank President Angpeng personally for his leadership in the state for a really long time. And that's kind of sad to hear that maybe it's this after midnight meeting now that's going to be your last testimony. And we talked in the hall earlier, and yes, you're retiring. And I was stunned to hear that, actually, because it just doesn't seem that that could be happening already. But, you know, I said the House really does not know a lot about this bill. And we did have a hearing, and President Anfang was there. And I said then, and it should be duly noted, that organized labor, exactly what President Anfang said, has never said, don't raise taxes. And so I don't have a problem with that at all, because that's the consistency. They're trying to do the right thing, put their people to work, and have not said that we shouldn't raise taxes. They know government costs money. It's the frustration with some other folks. But I guess I do want to, you know, thank you really on a personal level, President Anfang. I also want to say that I think, you know, I'm on the losing end of this deal, okay? I think most people are not with me. What I'm saying is I think if you knew that this was going to happen this year for sure, that you in your, you know, your record of representing your folks, you would want to know that it was designed in a way that it didn't put 1,000 people to work when it could put 5,000 people to work. And all I'm saying is I don't think anyone even knows the finite details of this plan yet, and there's a lot, and it's complicated. And I think sometimes people confuse intellectual curiosity and wanting to understand things with, you know, I'm trying to kill the thing. I've been clear on my position on these. I don't like them. But most legislators do. And so if we're going to try something new, which I agree, then it better take the best information we have, design it the best we can, and not just have people assert it'll do X. Well, show us how they know that. And so we can make choices in a menu. I mean, we watched Job Z get improved and improved because some things didn't work. And so I think if we're going to do this by Monday, we do have to have some folks really trying to work on this. I think there's a lot of good things in here. And I think the most objectionable thing personally to me isn't even the loan guarantee, it's the TIF stuff. So I think there's room for discussion, but I do think it should be noted if it's really President Anfang's sort of last hurrah here, and I'm glad it's with you, that he's really done a great service to lots of people in Minnesota and has been consistent as far as his willingness to support the needs of government. And I really do appreciate it, and I hope you have a good summer.
Well, I hope it's longer than the summer, Madam Chair. But thank you very much.
And
Mr. Chairman, there's some question about capacity or Deed, what they do. And I'd like to have somebody from Deed tell you that they probably do have the expertise to look at stuff. I hope that's what you're going to say.
Yes. Madam Chair, members, I'm Mark Loftus from Deed. Yes, I did feel compelled to speak up in behalf of our loan staff. We have a group of five people who make loans on a regular basis under the Minnesota Investment Fund. Over the last 24 years, I think we've made something like 350 loans under that program that are always in participation with the bank. We examine the investment by the private sector. We examine the cash flow, the industry standards by which that loan would be made and measured as is done in a bank. That is also the group that's involved in the 21st Century Mineral Fund, the loan agreements with that, so examining those proposals. And it's also the group that with our Ag Board, Ag and Economic Development Board, makes the decisions on the revenue bonds that we occasionally issue under the state's capacity for private activity bonds. So. And also the entire group, including several others outside that group in our department, have been trained by the National Development Council in the Economic Development Financing Training. So I just want to say for the record that we do have capacity within state government. One of our people is a former banker himself, and the other staff have been helped. He helps train them in some banking methods as well. So thank you for that time.
Representative Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Loftus, okay, so since you're here,
all right.
I know you're in here.
All right.
I do have a question for you then beyond that. Okay, so I know there's been a bunch of engrossments, so I could be off on this bill, but my understanding is in this bill, it allows DEED to charge a fee to participants in the program of 3% of the principal amount of the loan. Okay, so if the guarantee is 25% of the loan principal, which is how I understand it, then this fee could be 12% of that. So, the fee could hit 12% of the guaranteed amount. That seems like an extraordinarily high fee to me. And, I'd like to know about that. I mean, maybe DEED's not going to impose as high as a fee as the bill allows, but if the full fee was charged, you're talking about 13% of the total loan being the effective guarantee. It seems just like even if you're going to get into the banking on these private things, it seems a very ineffective deal for the recipient of the loan. So can you respond to that?
Madam Chair, in fairness to the author, we have not had discussion with him about the nature of our staffing in terms of the volume of that transaction and the amount of the premium that we would charge on that. We've not examined whether we would have to hire additional staff in this process because there's a substantial amount of activity involved in this. And the fact that we could have the capacity to charge a fee would probably help in identifying that. But we have a group of five staff people. It's also the group that examines the Job Z projects now because of their expertise. We added that responsibility to their office. It had formerly been in a different part of the department, so we had more expertise in the business financing area. So,
Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, okay. So, another question I have about this: if DEED were to use this in financing office or retail, DEED's expertise, in my estimation, should be targeted at those industries that need assistance most. And office space and retail seem to be driven by local markets on space. Okay, so would DEED support restricting this bill that both office and retail should not qualify for this kind of stuff?
Madam Chair, I don't know the bill in front of me. Does it prohibit office and retail, or does it include all types?
No.
I think it's all things.
Maybe in the most recent engrossment, but
I don't think.
Can someone show me where that is? Because Mr. Chair, I even asked, you weren't here, and we were doing one of Senator Saltzman's bills, and I was telling people that I listened to that bill on the tape in your committee because you had told me you wanted to, spend time on it, and so I couldn't quite hear it all, but I heard you, Senator Bach, speaking that should not be, retail should not be allowed. That was in the Saltzman bill. And, it seems to me that You have that view, so do I. And that would, for me, apply for TIF and for the loan guarantee. I mean, that would be helpful if they could not be used for retail projects. That could limit the scope a little, or office, which are vacancy, space-driven things. If that's in there in the loan guarantee, I looked for it really closely the last time, and I never saw it. So maybe it's now been added. So, I'll stand corrected on that. But it would seem to me that any TIF extensions and the loan guarantee would be expressly prohibited for retail or office.
Well, Madam Chair, that's always kind of been my position, and I guess I'm the one that in the Job Z program raised the whole retail prohibition, and we did, when we had the angel credit proposal here, include a retail prohibition in that. My feeling on retail has been if retail works, it's going to get built. And it just seems unfair to me to subsidize one retail development when down the road somebody selling the same products wasn't subsidized. So we've always been more than reluctant to include
retail.
That is in the TIF part. I mean, that's exactly what the Mall of America proposal does, is subsidize one retailer at the expense of everyone else. So, I mean, I'm glad we agree on that. I think I'm making headway with you on that one.
Chairman, we could take a look at that.
I didn't see it.
That's not what
we're going to find. Senator Metzen, tomorrow morning we're going to find out if the governor's got any interest in us putting some staff time into seeing if we can make something work here for Monday. And there's not a lot to work on around here by Monday, so there'll be adequate time if we can find out the governor has some interest. We have some other people would like to
testify. We have a couple more.
Representative Loftus.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Loftus, you made a comment that kind of dusted off something in the back of my mind. I just wasn't sure if I understood. You said, under the state's capacity for private activity bonds, and I seem to recall that at some point the feds put some limits on what we could couldn't do in bonding and those sorts of things. And can you tell me if that's a limit we need, how that would apply here? Or I wasn't quite sure about that comment, about the under the state's capacity for private activity bonds.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, under federal law, and Mr. Michael is far more expert in federal law, tax law than I am, but under federal law, Minnesota, like every other state, has access to tax-exempt bonds that can be used for what's described private activity, including private manufacturing businesses. So a private manufacturer would come to us and say, we want to put up a manufacturing facility. The state can finance that up to, I think it's something currently in the range of $80 million a year is accessed for economic development purposes for manufacturing under that portion that Minnesota has. I believe it's based on population. Under federal law, until the federal stimulus package passed on March 19th, I believe it was, those funds could only be used for capital expenditures and for under the stimulus bill for an 18-month period. It changed the allowable activities to include working capital and intellectual property and patents and know-how. So there's a window to try to expand where the kinds of manufacturing and kind of costs that are done in relationship with manufacturing, if that's what your question is.
Representative Loeffler.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, and how does that relate to the loan guarantee? That's where I wasn't quite sure how we're relating those two.
Madam Chair, Senator, Representative Loeffler, I don't know that there is a relationship here. You're just saying that we can guarantee private loans, private financing that goes into a project. The state would guarantee 25% of that, regardless of the. I mean, we're talking about construction financing.
No, that's good. It's going to be can be both. It could be construction and takeout. So, but there's no bonding provisions in this.
Senator Metzen, I think we should get some of the other people that have sat here a couple nights and want to have an opportunity to testify.
I agree.
Senator Scoy.
You know, Mr. Chair, why the next group is coming up. You know, when I listen to those architects talk, you know, a former logger and a farmer, I've always kind of had a hard time getting my head around this idea economy, you know, because I always thought, well, you had to grow something or dig it out of the ground or cut it down or, you know, to make economy. But here in Minnesota, we evidently have developed this infrastructure for architects and financing that they're exporting this all across the country and around the world. And you know, it takes a long time to build that kind of infrastructure up. And, you know, if we lose that, I think the guy's right. We won't ever get that back again. And, you know, if that's part of this new idea economy that we have, where you can have real production just from people's ideas and economic activity, you know, that's something that we really got to be paying attention to, because I think the gentleman's right. I think we'd lose that, and it'll be in, you know, Boston or goodness knows where next, and that'll hurt this state for years and years and years to come.
Mr. Simrod.
Senator and Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Dave Simrad, Chief Executive for the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. Most of what I was planning to say has already been said, so in the interest of time, I won't go over those details, but I will make a few comments. In terms of the banking underwriting requirements, they're going to be more stringent now than ever. So in terms of there being banking safeguards, and anybody that's in commercial real estate today or construction knows what it's like to go in today to renew your line of credit or to get funding for a new project. It's a lot more stringent today than it has ever been, and those projects are still going to have to be going through those underwriting requirements to be funded. Secondly, to Representative Lucheski's point about the risk to the state, and I understand that. When I first came into this industry, I was a safety and loss prevention person, and that's what my job was, to assess risk on construction projects. And I would say that we have an opportunity here that we may not see any time again like we see it today. The risk to the state, I believe, and I think I'm speaking for our industry, which are the major commercial and heavy builders in the state, the risk is not taking advantage of this opportunity. I will tell you that we're going to lose 25% of our 400 members if this economy continues in the path that it is going right now. And when you look at construction companies as an asset to the state, and I think that's what you have to do, is these construction firms employ skilled, educated, trained individuals, both on the management and the employee side, and that is a tremendous asset to this state. And if we lose that asset, it's going to be years before we recover. And we're proud of our industry. As mentioned previously by Mr. Herman or Mr. Hamilton, Minnesota has a reputation of having some of the best building and highway contractors in the country, in the world. You don't build a bridge across the Mississippi River like we did with 35W without an expert team. And I know that's heavy construction, and that's a little bit out of what we're talking about right here. But that's the quality of contractor, the quality of professional that we have in the state. We're going to lose many of those firms. We have 18,000 construction firms in this state, and 95% of them employ 20 people or fewer. So these are small businesses. These businesses are not asking for a handout. That's the last thing that we want from this state. This is the last thing that we want from you legislative leaders. But what we do expect is leadership. We have come together as a coalition to put our collective ideas together, and we have individuals in our group, lawyers, designers, degreed engineers, MBAs, CPAs. We didn't come together and just dream these things up. We came together to put a list of ideas in front of all of you as tools so that you could help an industry that is under severe stress right now. So without going on any further, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just leave that as my parting comment. Extreme measures for extreme times. This is not business as usual, and we understand that. But if we don't take advantage of this opportunity, we're letting the industry down, and I think the many, many individuals in the industry that really rely on you for leadership. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer.
Bob Schreier, Director of Community Development, City of Brooklyn Park, and I have the task of talking about tax increment financing. In Brooklyn Park, we were fortunate with the federal stimulus package at 610 will be extended within 2 miles of its completed destination. And along that route, so that's horizontal construction, we'd like to see some vertical construction. And along there, I had two large master planned developments, equaling 1.9 million square feet of office, the other 700,000 square feet of office, along with some high-density housing and on both sites. And both of those, we in cities look at permanent jobs and we look at office jobs, our high-value jobs, and would produce about 8,700 permanent jobs. Now, that doesn't include the construction jobs. The cities were late into the coalition. So in order to do this, we look at, and in Brooklyn Park, I don't have, well, in along 610, there's not a lot of redevelopment areas, so what I call, we use the economic development or the short districts. So from cities' perspectives, and maybe even in greater Minnesota, you look at how you can get that infrastructure built, and many times you need longer tax increment districts. And when we got in to look at what we were talking about here in the stimulus package as it relates to tax increment, originally we thought that we would put the extension on tax increment districts at 10 years for new tax increment districts. And then when we were in the coalition, we have partners that have some existing tax increment districts, and the feeling was that they could utilize those existing districts. It was added the 10 years on existing districts. But from a suburban area, or from a suburban area, Brooklyn Park's northwest of Minneapolis, you know, we looked at it was more important for new tax increment districts, new projects in this tough time, because we're trying to spur that office development with the high-paying jobs that we believe will bring new revenue into the city, long-term projection on taxes after the tax increment ends. And, of course, the city councils have to decide to do tax increment districts plus building permits. So we can talk about that tax increment piece. There's a lot of different ways to do that. When I was in St. Paul, for example, working in St. Paul, when I needed more time on a district, I decertified districts and created a new, you know, decertify old district and created a new tax increment district. But, you know, you can do this many different ways. But really, we were looking at it to get projects going to meet the gap, because to do the infrastructure along 610 to get these other big projects going, I needed some more time than that was given in the existing economic development district. So we can talk about tax increment.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and excuse me if this has already been answered because I got here late, and I apologize. How many new jobs will this bill create?
Mr. Cimarron, any idea? Have we done any math?
Representative Marquardt, as close as we can get to that is we've done some calculations, and there was a survey done earlier by the Associated General Contractors of America and a study at George Mason University. $500 million of infrastructure investment would create about 10,500 jobs. Of those, 3,500 would be on-site jobs, 1,700 would be direct or indirect jobs, and 5,250 would be other jobs, and that's for $500 million.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, is there any way we could get some documentation on that by tomorrow? Just kind of what you're reading there. Could we kind of see the methodology or the analysis of,
absolutely,
of that? I think that would be
absolutely
helpful. And the other thing, I guess I'm coming back to Representative Lincheski's concern is, you know, under the guarantee criteria, under on the second page under the temporary loan guarantee, it says that 2.15 and on, it says the commissioner shall require information from an applicant concerning the number of jobs involved and the wages expected. And that goes on 2.17, and may consider the number of jobs created in relation to the amount of a loan guarantee. And then when you get to the TIF stuff on 15.30 and so forth, it says a project determined to create or retain jobs. And if you have the methodology there, I think there should be a benchmark. And I know when Commissioner Ines or Commissioner McElroy was in, I can't remember, they were talking about their plan of all their stuff. I asked them, you know, how many jobs will this create? I mean, we're putting the state investment out. We should have some benchmarks. And so I think it's fair. I mean, I would feel very strongly that there would be some benchmarks written into the criteria. I mean, X amount of jobs per 1 million or whatever that would be. And I think that's what you're calculating, because you were calculating out of $500 million of infrastructure or whatever, you would create 10,500 jobs. But I just think it's, as Representative Chesky, you know, on this TIF, it could be one job, or it might not even be a new job. It could be even be retaining one job. And I just think when we are in a $6.4 billion deficit and very limited dollars, that we've got to make sure we're going to get a good bang for the buck. You know, and I would feel much more comfortable if there were some benchmarks or guaranteed new jobs created for before you could do something. I think that would create even the projects and the developers to say, okay, we've got to create this. How do we do it? And I think would even force everyone to think of more creative ways to create jobs, and how can we maximize our dollars and leverage our dollars to the greatest amount if you had a set amount of jobs.
Well, Representative Mark Ward, nobody's going to build a vertical building for whatever use and take on the debt service of it if the project doesn't work. I mean, I think we have a pretty good idea what the construction impact is going to be, the jobs it's going to create. These guys can tell you to within, I mean, a pretty small number of man hours per square foot, how many man hours it's going to take to build the building. And I mean, we know what that's going to be. I don't think anybody's going to dispute that. But the owner of the building, I mean, I don't quite understand the point. I mean, we know what the economic activity relative to the construction is. And so I don't quite understand where you're going. I mean, the owner wouldn't be building the building and taking on the debt service if the project didn't work after it was constructed. I don't quite see where you're going.
And, Mr. Chair, I agree with that. And that's why I think if someone was to go ahead with a project, they would say, you know, this many jobs are going to be created. I'm going to employ this many people at a minimum. And I don't know this $500 million for 10,500 jobs. Let's just accept that. You know, what does that equate into $1 million? I mean, just somehow there should be a floor that if we're going to invest this amount of money, we're going to be guaranteed this many jobs. And it wouldn't have to be, you know, it could be a floor. It wouldn't have to be a high amount, but just something that we could say if someone asked me, what do we get for this? We are guaranteed, and I don't think we do enough of this around here. And to say, here's what we're guaranteeing. I mean, a lot of times we talk about the bonding bill. I know that creates, I think when we did the $1 billion, it was like 30,000 new jobs or whatever. We did the gas tax and so forth. There was so many jobs. And I think that's a way in which we can be accountable to our taxpayers that this is what we're purchasing. And I agree, and I've heard everyone, it is jobs, and we need to create jobs. And I think if we had benchmarks in here, it would bring people to the table even more to create those even before they think of going ahead with the project.
Mr. Sermon, a comment on that?
Representative Marquardt and Senator, we try to do, in the construction industry today, we try to do more with less. Mr. Anfang and I, and I'm sure, Senator, we could debate this, but we have productivity improvement as you know, down to a science. And, for example, if you were to construct this Capitol building today, you would use far fewer workers than were used when it was first built, simply because of technology and productivity improvement techniques and so forth. So actually, we're always challenged to try and use fewer workers, and I know that's maybe not what you wanted to hear, but I mean that's what we try to do because we think that is value added. You're actually giving the owner, you know, a better value for their dollar invested.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a TIF question before?
Representative Teske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's Mr. Schreier, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and you know I don't know if. This is just my thoughts on the TIF part. I mean, we're spending a lot of time on the loan guarantee, but I do want to tackle the TIF part because I think that's the most objectionable part of this bill for me personally. You know, we had a big argument in here about Central Corridor TIF.
Not an argument.
A discussion.
Very good.
That was child's play compared to what's proposed. I'd do 20 of those before I'd do this. Okay, I mean this is, and I just want to you know talk about why because I think
I'm for
you
that.
Have a motion. I'm
fall back to this.
Sir Dibble, do you have a motion?
I move this Brooklyn Park to care.
Well, and I think if Brooklyn Park has an issue, we'd like to hear what their particular issue is, and they could put in a bill. I think 610 is going to have a massive edge on development over folks that don't have 610 going through. So I don't think it. You know, needs the subsidy, but I guess, you know, here's the issue with the TIF part for me, okay? It's basically, at its core, what it is it's a massive property tax increase to fund this. I mean, that's what it is. It's TIF is sort of financing this stimulus with property tax increases. So, you know, let's just think about, you know, how does this work? I mean, and I was a city council member, so was Representative Marquardt. Weren't you a locally? Who else was a locally elected official?
County.
Okay, so
I worked for one.
So this is how great TIF is. I mean, of course, if you're the city council member, and you need to buy something for $100 straight up on the property tax, and you got to visibly, transparently pay $100, it's $100. But if you use TIF, you can get the county tax base and the school tax base, and you get $100 of stuff for $40. So, of course, cities love TIF because they get to offload all these costs onto these other units of government. They get to superficially, dramatically expand their property tax base. They get to reach past their borders and grab other people's property taxes, and the net effect of that are property tax increases. So, you know, I'm not a fan of this anyhow, but, you know, in this bill, when you read the language, I mean, this is not for stimulus projects. This is not for shovel-ready stuff. You don't even have to start till 2013. We're going to be long out of the recession by then. 2013? It's 2009. So, I mean, you know, if we were ever going to pursue any of this, this would be like, you know, you got to be underway in 6 months or something. That would be a stimulus project to me. But, you know, this becomes a way for cities to just shift planned capital improvements they were going to do anyhow onto county and school taxpayers. To me, there's no stimulative effect if you're using TIF. I mean, all it's doing is you're just taking things that would have been financed by city through direct, transparent property tax increases or special assessments or levies, and moving them over here to TIF. That there's no stimulative effect there. It's just moving the spending around. And so, I mean, I guess. You know, I asked Mr. Michael and Mr. Hines prepared for me. We had this hearing, like I stated, in the House. And, you know, the 10-year, you know, letting everybody have an extra 10 years. I mean, we went through a really diligent process in the House, and we didn't let people get an extra year. And then we came to this committee and let two cities who would have qualified for other kinds of TIFs when they certified get a couple years. And we didn't let Central Corridor. I mean, this would just sort of blow open the gates. And just I was trying to put together in my head, you know, what's the property tax increase effect of this bill? And we know that there are others around here who say they don't raise taxes, but what they really do is they go raise property taxes. Those are tax increases. Well, that's what this does, too. And if I can just tell you, and I'll pass this out, this is what the House Nonpartisan Research said. They did a back-of-the-envelope analysis to look at what could be the potential impact to taxpayers for TIF districts being extended by 10 years, and they made some assumptions that districts were within 7 years of expiration. So you have to make some assumptions, but a conservative assumption, they took out the pre-79 TIF districts because those wouldn't be eligible in this language, The pre-75-9s aren't eligible. So the results were that approximately 640 of our 2,050 districts, we have almost 2,100 TIF districts, would probably extend it under the proposal. Those 640 districts currently generate $131 million a year, about a 1.8% total property tax burden statewide. So the effect of this is the average state taxpayer's burden will go up, property tax, 1.8% by passing this bill, and a conservative estimate of the 10-year effect based on a 5% annual growth would be a $1.7 billion property tax increase. I mean, I just don't think in good conscience when we're staring down what's going to happen here and potential unallotments and we're making choices. You know, I get the jobs thing, but when people get their LGA cut, people are going to lose jobs. And when county aid gets cut, people are going to lose jobs. And when hospitals close, people are going to lose jobs. And when, you know, teachers get laid off because we're not going to fund schools, it's all jobs. And we have to make these choices. And so for me, putting money up against money, all under jobs, we better know what works. And the TIF to me is the absolute most objectionable because it's doing what others have been doing. And I mean, I don't like naming names, but I mean, I will say it. You know, the governor, that's sort of the MO. When times get tough, don't raise state taxes, go raise property taxes. That's exactly what this TIF provision does. And I personally don't want to own a $1.7 billion property tax increase, a conservative estimate, over the life of the provision in this bill. And I really think it's important we think through what we're doing here and think of other ways to create jobs. I'll restate, I think the loan guarantee is less objectionable than any extensions of TIF. And I just think we need to think this through.
Madam Chair, I think the advocates of this have brought forth a proposal with a menu of things that they think could help stimulate the industry, and I don't think anybody in this room thinks they're going to get everything in this bill, but I mean, Madam Chair, this morning the first people that came to see me in my office were a couple people that came to advocate for the Racino, and I've never been a supporter of gambling, voted against the lottery in 1988 when it was on the ballot, because I'm just not a believer the state should be in the gaming business. But I spent a couple minutes with them, Madam Chair, and I thanked them because at least they're proposing some kind of a solution. They're advocating for something. And to the people in this room, I just want to thank you for coming here and advocating for something to see if we can pull together some pieces out of this maybe that'll do something to stimulate this industry. I mean, a lot of people have put a lot of work into this, and now I guess it's kind of up to us and the governor if any of this is going to bear any fruit, but I certainly want to do my part to see if we can try to do something to stimulate this industry, and we might find out that we pass something here and maybe we do the loan guarantee part and we might come back here next year and find out that not one project went. That it just, in these financial markets, it just wasn't enough. But at least we will have tried. And that's what worries me the most, is that we just have this feeling that, well, things will get better by themselves. And in the meantime, to Senator Descoy's part, point, are the people, infrastructure around this industry disappear? And how do you rebuild that, especially if we're an exporter of this kind of expertise? How do you rebuild that? Because it's built up over probably a couple generations of time.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and you know, I don't think you're personally criticizing me or I'm personally criticizing you, but I want to say something to the greater debate, and that is, I do not like these, but it isn't the same because I oppose them to say that folks who feel like me aren't doing something, because we have to take this $100 million appropriation in this bill and the sales tax losses, I mean, there is a cost to this bill, and put it up against LGA cuts, and put it up against county aid, and put it up against school funding, and put it up against, so I don't think there's anybody who doesn't want to do something. It is, in the end, choices, and to me, all those things create jobs, and it gets into the role of government, the mission of government. Is it good at playing in the private sector? I personally don't think so, but you know, I just would hate to leave those who are looking for, you know, job creation with the impression that if you don't like this, then you're not willing to do anything, or that you're somehow, your opposition to a bill means, you know, you're not doing anything. I just reject that, because I do think when you fund schools and when you fund higher ed and when you fund transportation and when you fund local government aid and county aid, you're doing something, and that's jobs too. And it's something that government does better and can control. So I know you weren't saying that about me, but I think sometimes people like to characterize that when someone's an opponent of one thing, that means they're not doing anything. And I don't think that's accurate. I think we just disagree what the, you know, net return on the dollar is as far as doing this kind of stuff. And I've said, I think most legislators are a fan of these things. And so if we're going down this road, past experience tells us we better know what we're doing with the best research we have in the tightest way than just, hey, this is an idea, let's just see if it works. And I think that would be very irresponsible for the legislature, because like you just said, hey, we could do this and nothing could happen. The flip could be the case. Things could just be rip-roaring building, and we would never know, was half of that because of this bill? Or did half of it happen because we came out of the recession? Or is there a substitution effect? This project got funded, but that one didn't. And so there's a lot of things going on in an economy that are really hard to pinpoint, and that's where I think government doesn't do well and should try to stay out of it. But I think we just philosophically disagree. But I know that you're trying your best, and you feel strongly, and I hope you see that about me too.
Madam Chair, I think education is probably one of the most important things we do in any legislative session. But I can tell you, and I think Representative Marquardt and Representative Conan and Senator Scoy will agree with me, you know, the state puts about $10,000 a pupil into kids in school that I grew up in, and we do a pretty good job. And I know it's served that little school served me pretty well. Served my sons that graduated from there pretty well. It seems like they're off on pretty good careers. Although I talked to the one that works for U.S. Steel today, and he's getting pretty nervous. He's a licensed engineer. But, Madam Chair, just if all we're going to do is educate them, I can tell you what happens in my little town. We do a pretty good job of it. And then they go off to college, and they never come back because there's no opportunity for them in Clearbrook, probably little in Dilworth. And so it just, important as it is, by itself, it's just not enough in many, many areas of the state. So we just have to figure out how we do more, so that for those people that once they've completed their education have an opportunity to live, maybe they want to live in the little town that they grew up in. And these kind of industries, young people, in my dad, when he got out of World War II, went to Dunwoody and moved back to the range, and it was booming. We were building LTV, and we were building reserve mining. And anybody who wanted to work could work on the Iron Range, and a lot of people in the Twin Cities migrated there. And new towns came up out of the potato fields in Babbitt, White Lakes. And that was my dad's experience after World War II, and I will always remember him telling me that if you learn how to do something with your hands, you will never be hungry, because there always will be a place you can go. And we got a whole lot of people behind this infrastructure in this room that want to work, and they've got good skills, and somehow the banking industry has frozen them out, and they've got good projects on the ground that should go. Owners with projects that their project they think works, but the bank won't take the risk. And behind it is all these people with tool belts and toolboxes that are some of the hardworking, most productive people in the world. And we got to put them to work. And Senator Metz and I mean, this is an incredible effort on your part. And I hope we find out, I hope we find out in the morning from the governor that he wants to get in the game here and we try and do something. But I guess we're probably going to find out tomorrow whether we're going to spend any more time on this or not.
Chairman, let me just say that I apologize a little bit for getting a little excited, but I am very passionate about this. I've been on it for about 4 months. I've been working on it, been through 6 different committees, and I got a little excited at one time. And I'm sorry about that, but this is an idea. We're trying to do something. These people have been working their butts off. It's going on 6 months now, and we've got an idea. And we think we've got a fairly good idea. All the parts of the puzzle might not work for all you folks here, and we understand that. But we're trying. We're trying to be positive. We're trying to do something. We're trying to get people back to work. So if I get a little excited, it's because I got excited. I just like what we're doing here, and I think we've got a good idea.
Senator Metzen, there are a lot of people depending on you. Senator Metzen, does anybody else want to testify on your bill?
We've got a 30, 40 people here out of the 85 or 90 of the coalition that have taken the time to come over here, so we appreciate that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, I think it's great when people get excited about ideas. And
you said
you've been working on it, and it sounds like a lot of people in this room have been working on it for 4 months. And for some of us, this is still sort of like a new concept because we haven't been part of that whole dream and figuring it out. And the one thing that struck me is when we started out, there was the comment made about there's potentially $3 to $5 billion in projects. I mean, and we're not used to hearing big positive numbers, particularly in this particular time. And, you know, even if you were able to do the full what's here, that's nowhere near that. And what I don't see is really how the priorities get set. And, you know, Representative Marquardt talked about the benchmarks, and I think that's got to be part of the key, too, because it's got to be about we're all going to be held accountable for if something went forward. You know, how do you – who's the winners and who's the losers? And are, you know, beyond the construction jobs, are the jobs in the buildings good jobs? Are they new jobs for the person who's sitting collecting an unemployment check, or is it stealing the jobs from one community and moving them to another community, and there's no net gain? You just fill up a new building, and you got an empty building now that's a burden on another community and lowers its tax base because of the way we value commercial industrial property is based on the rents. If you got a vacant building and nobody wants it, you know, you got a problem. So I'm just trying to it feels like we need to do a little bit more thinking about that. In terms of, I don't see that really kind of sorted out here on what kind of jobs and who gets to the front of the line, if there is a line, and that sort of thing.
We'll look at some of those numbers and see if we can't figure something out. I think you're onto something, and all we know is it's going to create a lot of jobs. But thank you also so very much.
Anything further, members?
Mr. Chair, just in closing, I mean, if we do come back to this at all, I do think there is so much going on in this that we really have not even touched on yet. We're going to have to talk about it. And if people are serious, it's got to get fixed, I think, to earn House support. And one area we have not talked about at all in this TIF part is the LGA shifts. And there are serious LGA impacts as it relates to allowing people to extend TIF. I mean, if you have LGA now and you're on the formula and you don't have TIF districts to certify when they're scheduled to decertify, and you're not subject to caps, and you extend a TIF district, you're going to shift money of LGA into that city away from other cities. So what you're going to do is you're going to say to those who would choose to extend a TIF district under this bill, you're going to be a winner here. Because you're going to get more LGA and you're going to take it from someone else. And we have to understand all that. We have to think these details through.
Madam Chair, I don't think the advocates in this room want to get bogged down with how the TIF formula moves money around. So let me make an offer to you.
Yeah.
I'll take the TIF piece out right now. Let's take it off the table. Okay, you win. You win. Okay? You win one. Big one. Ms. Cadoon, we took the TIF off the table. Tell the governor there's no more TIF. Let's talk about the loan guarantee and the other provisions. Okay. Because I don't want to get filibustered to death here in the final days of the session about every little thing that moves around. These people don't care about that. They just want to go to work. And time is short. You know, unfortunately, we got hung up on the floor the last, three, four nights and couldn't get here. And my apology to all of you that were so patient waiting for a night when we finally could get around to this. We'd have done this days ago if our respective floor leaders in the House and the Senate had given this committee some time to get some work done. And, Madam Chair, I know a lot of them, little general orders we're going through up there are important to people. Okay? But we're running out of time to get some really important work done in this room, too. So, anything else? Senator Metzen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gavel's yours tomorrow, Madam Chair.
10 maybe? 10 or 11?
10 or 11.
Just check your posting, maybe 10 or 11-ish.
You're talking night or morning?
Morning. we'll try to post yet tonight.
Okay. Anything else, members? Committee adjourned.